But that all changed in 1971 because a certain gentleman by the name of Henry Kissinger went to China. And the following year, Nixon went to China. Suddenly, North Korea knew that if there was a showdown again, they could not necessarily rely on China. They thought about it a couple of months, and they made an overture to South Korea and said, "This is silly, let's have a peace treaty." They did have talks, and there was a sort of a loose joint agreement saying that it'd be a good idea to pursue, but nothing particularly happened. And every year since, in their New Year's speech, the successive Kims have asked for a peace treaty. In 73, it was clear that they weren't getting anywhere in South Korea. They wrote a letter to the House of Representatives and the Senate in the States asking for a peace treaty. They have never had a reply.
And so here we are today.
Yeah. Why have they never had a reply? Well, the answer is quite simple. It has nothing to do with North Korea. It has nothing to do with North Korea. I'll give you a documented quote from Condoleezza Rice.
Which is not necessarily the best person to be able to.
Well, it exposes the extreme cynicism of the situation and the complete lack of respect for other human life if you're not American. The quote is that North Koreans are like some sort of roadkill on the highway of history. Really, all of this that's going on is about America's, the United States, containment of China policy.
Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Green Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Green Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth. As New Zealand, also known as Aotearoa, this small green country in the South Pacific has a special role to play in the world. That, because we are physically isolated from other countries of our planet, we are in a unique position to be able to observe them all and interact with them. And from this perspective, realize just how fortunate we are to have such a peaceful nation that has ample clean air, fresh water, and a huge landmass to be able to obtain our food and quality shelter. Yet the challenge for us is not to slip into complacency and self-satisfaction, and that we use our capacity and our potential to initiate positive change for a regenerative global society, and that we truly become ecologically aware of the magnificence of nature, as well as engage in conscious community where we cooperate and collaborate more so that we can bring up our children in a dynamic, synergistic, and holistic environment where visionaries can chart a new tomorrow. To get there, we need to have citizen diplomacy, where through New Zealand's Cool Schools Learning Program, we train up in the art of conflict resolution and reconciling opposing points of view. And by taking on the mantle of higher ideals, have New Zealand be the country that stands out as a moral compass for good and a fair global player, so as to be the change we wish to see in the world. And doing this by sending out from our shores peaceful ambassadors who will take the nuclear-free message that we have held for 30 years and share with all kin around the curve of our great sustainer, Mother Earth, so that we can take us into tomorrow where we can have a world of perfect peace. This is more than an ideal. This is an action plan. In the studio this morning, I have Peter Wilson, and Peter is from the NZDPRK Society, which is the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, also called North Korea And he's come in to illuminate us a little more about what is happening in that country that people know so little about, but have taken on so much information that is maybe not correct. So, kia ora, Peter. Thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Peter, you have been involved with this society for some time, and you've visited North Korea. So I'm going to let you open up straight away. You've been back in New Zealand in the last 2 weeks. So what took you to North Korea?
Well, I was thinking about that driving over to come and see you, Tim, and I realised that today is my birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Always good.
And I celebrated my birthday exactly 20 years ago in Pyongyang, North Korea. And I was there working for a small United Nations agency by the name of International Fund for Agricultural Development. Now, North Korea is kept out of the international system because the United States has kept them out of the IMF. And because they're not a member of the IMF,
the International Monetary Fund,
they don't have access. They cannot belong to the World Bank. They cannot belong to the regional development banks like the Asian Development Bank. But the Americans must have blinked one day, because somehow North Korea became a member of the International Fund for Agricultural Development, which is just a mini, compared with the World Bank, it's only a little mini, it's a multilateral financing institution. And I spent 40 years of my entire professional career, I spent working right throughout Asia. I worked in 21 different countries over a 40-year period.
Wow.
Working in all the poorest and problem areas. And that took me in 1997 to North Korea because they were at the height of their food crisis at that time. And at that stage, we were typically writing a loan from International Fund for Agricultural Development. But because of that crisis project, that program was a $50 million project, fertilizer, improved crop production. And my little role in it was I had $13 million of that $50 million. And that was all for increasing production of small livestock, which was ducks and geese and sheep. And goats.
Okay.
So that's how I first went there. And I knew little about the country, probably less than the average person in the public today knows, because today we're getting a lot more stuff in our papers about it. But I very quickly realised that what little I did know, it really didn't stand up with what I'm seeing with my eyes. And life in North Korea is very different from what it is portrayed to us through our media.
Okay, because what we hear from the Australian media, we see impoverished rogue state, secretive state, the world's most isolated and Orwellian state, and a nuclear weapon state, a state of religious cult, and on, a failed state, a police state. Peter, what did you see when you went there just last time?
Well, I'm interested that you quote that. That same study that looked at the Australian media and picked up that all these negative adjectives precede the words North Korea also looked at the words that precede South Korea. And there are zero negative adjectives, typically, in our media, preceding the word South Korea. So we don't realise it, but we have been conditioned to look at North Korea in a very negative way. I just did a highly unscientific thing just this last week, and I just went back and I got a whole lot of articles that are presented in the Herald. And the Herald is good. There's a lot of stuff about Korea there, North Korea. But the sources of those articles, Bloomberg, Reuters, head office New York,
yes.
Time.
New York Times.
New York Times. Washington Post.
Yes.
So they're all American sources, and they reflect Washington. Washington looks through the world through a different prism from us down here in New Zealand, and of course their media reflects that, and it is not true.
Can I just interject here? Because strangely enough, Trump will point the finger at all those and say they're fake news as well. So, I mean, this is the contradiction and the world that we're living in. It's double talk, isn't it? 1984 all over again. George Orwell.
Well, there's lots of, there are a lot of ironies in life. I agree, yeah. I just came back from 10 days in North Korea. That was my seventh visit. On two of the occasions, I have worked there, and on five of the occasions, I have represented the NZDPRK society there. I thought that North Korea wouldn't surprise me any more because I have got to know it quite well and have got some great friends there. But I have really come back this time a little bit staggered because the place, a country. I went expecting to see it down at heel and everybody not in good heart. The place is booming. I couldn't believe it. There's so many more cars on the streets since I was there just 24 months ago. The shops are bursting with consumer goods, including luxury goods, which are meant to be kept out by the sanctions. And everybody is so proud. They are so proud of what, as a little country, they are achieving in terms of their satellites, missiles. They're incredibly proud of it. Not just the top brass, the people in the street. Furthermore, the Central Bank of South Korea published a study just recently, and they say that they believe that the North Korean economy grew by 3.9% last year. I fully believe it. In fact, looking at it, I'd be surprised if it isn't a lot more. And when I talk to their government people, they say, well, it is more. I don't know about all this sort of stuff, but what they say is that the way they measure GDP growth is really set up for a 100% market economy, and they say that formula that they use doesn't capture a lot of stuff that's done in North Korea, which is done by the government. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if, in fact, their growth is greater than the 3.9%. Certainly, going and visiting there from time to time, you can see it happening. The place is really, the standards of living are really increasing, and it's quite different from what is portrayed in our media.
This is very profound. A lot of people won't sort of understand what you're saying at one level, but you've been on the ground there, Peter, and you've seen it, and you've spoken to a lot of people. Where did you travel? Where did you take this information in from?
Well, I mean, I have a perspective, as I've said, going back 20 years, and I've spent my whole life going and working in different countries, and to be effective to work in those countries, you have to understand the system, where the power is, who's up who, and if you don't understand that sort of political context, social context, you can't really understand what's going on. So I'm not trying to blow my own trumpet, but I've had a lifetime, really, of going into strange situations and having to assess them all and then be productive within that context.
As a part of a New Zealand government?
No, I always worked as a freelancer. I don't fit well into the bureaucracy, so I spent 40 years basically working as a freelancer, and I was picked up by such agencies as the World Bank and Asian Development Bank and Food and Agriculture Organization and UNDP and all these people. And unlike a lot of people doing that sort of work, I often said no when I was offered a job. I mean, the early years I did long-term jobs, like I was 2 years in Papua New Guinea and then I was 4 years in the Philippines, implementing long-term projects. But from that, I morphed into sort of short-term stuff, which was project planning and supervising and troubleshooting. You were asking me how I assess North Korea. So that's my background. And so when I'm saying what I saw this time, it's with that sort of contextual background of being practiced, really, in assessing a situation in a country and deciding where the truth lies and working accordingly. And I think that my track record of being picked up by those international agencies over the years showed that most of your mum, well, even though I say it myself, my judgment has proven to be quite good. So, yes, yeah. It's contrary to what we common perception of North Korea, but I can assure you that anybody going there within 24 hours would be saying, well, this is a bit surreal because it's not what I've been told.
Yes, well, the American black indoor basketballer, Dennis Rodman, who goes there regularly.
Yes.
He says, well, look, it's another story.
Mm.
But he too has been sort of pushed back by the media because they don't want to have a bridgehead opening up and saying, hey, there's another story that we need to look at. And so can you tell us some of the things that you did see? You know, when they did have that drought and there was a famine.
Right.
I mean...
Well, I've got a little bit of a unique insight into that because what North Korea was telling the world in the early 90s was that they had exceptional drought, exceptional floods, exceptional weather events, and that therefore they were drastically short of food. And travel in the country was restricted. World Food Programme and FAO, Food and Agriculture, both UN agencies got involved because clearly there was a problem there. But their people weren't allowed to travel and they just accepted what they were told in Pyongyang. Now, when we went in 97, which had been going for some years, the International Fund for Agricultural Development said, well, we've got $50 million that you can have access to for increasing your food production, but our people have to see what the situation is. So I was privileged to really be in the team, one of the first, maybe the first Western team ever, certainly one of the first, to travel extensively right through the country. And what we were looking at didn't gel with what North Korea was telling the world, because people were not dying by the thousands.
Or eating grass.
Or eating grass. Yep, they were short of food. But the statistics that we immediately got hold of showed that there wasn't a huge increase in the deaths of the elderly or children. Yep, they were up a little bit, but not a lot. And amongst the team was an Aussie bloke that I never liked very much. He was an arrogant sort of fellow, but his job was to get the statistics out of the government. And he was like a fox terrier. He was at them, at them, at them. And then one night he came back to the hotel and he said, I've got it. And they'd released the stats. And what it clearly showed was, and I should just make the comment here, that North Korea, the ground's frozen 6 months of the year. If you go and ask them what's your climate here, they don't say we get so many sunshine hours or so much inches of rain. They say we have 172 frost-free days a year. So in 6 months, they have to work, and that's why North Koreans are such hard workers. Historically, they've had to work really hard through the spring, summer and autumn and grow enough food to eat through the coming winter.
Because it's quite mountainous too, isn't it?
And it's mostly mountainous. It's only about 15% arable, and there's actually not quite enough land there to, even though their agriculture is very good, technically very good, they maximise their production, they just can't, not quite enough. So they've always been reliant on getting some top-up of food. And that the amount varies. I mean, it can be as much as 500,000 tonnes of grain. It can be less. But it depends on the season. So it's up and down. Now, up until 89-90, or up until 88, actually, I mean, they were part of the USSR system, and they were plugged into the USSR trading markets.
With the Soviets.
With the Soviets. And Hungary and Bulgaria and all those countries. And so they were plugged into the whole system, and they were making a lot of heavy machinery that went into that system and all the payments and everything. They had virtually no trade with the West at all. Now, they were getting cheap diesel, they were getting cheap fertilizer. And then when they needed their top-up, they were able to access quite cheap grain. But that all collapsed, and suddenly they had nowhere to go. In fact, the thing that set off the rot was that Russia was in trouble, and in 88 they demanded that payment not be in rubles for the top-up of food and the fertiliser and so forth, but it be in hard currency. Well, they didn't have any hard currency.
A bit like Cuba.
I guess. Well, there's a lot of parallels between the two, and why does the states to this very day keep them aside? But that's another issue. So we suddenly knew the truth, and that was why they were short of food, and they didn't have anywhere to go, so they kind of cried wolf. They over-exaggerated the situation so that they could get, so that the Oxfams and the World Food Programs and the charity agencies would give them free food. That was quite clever and did work, but they were exaggerating it. And to this day, there are people that say that, you know, there were 2 or 3 million people died. That's not true. Yes, there would have been some deaths, but they had a census assisted by the UN, I think, in 2008, and the population was 24 million. Now, if there'd been 2 or 3 million died during the 90s, there wouldn't have been 24 million there. Yep, some died. Maybe it could have been 250,000, max 750,000, but I suspect it might have been 300,000 or 400,000 deaths were premature because of that. So that situation still pertains. The World Food Programme stepped in, New Zealand contributed to at that time, and alleviated that situation. And then George Bush came in and he put in an American director of the World Food Programme, who immediately put a letter out to all the countries of the world and said, well, really, there's more need in Africa. And so the World Food Programme contribution to their food top-up each year declined down drastically. But since then, their economy has actually been growing, and I haven't actually looked this last year, but the graph is clearly there that every year they have been buying commercially on the world markets the grain that they need for their annual top-up.
I see. Okay, yes. Well, challenges still are plenty, but as you say, backdooring into China, there's always an opportunity for them to be able to get, shall we say, consumer goods.
Oh, well, the consumer goods are flowing. As I said before, it's clear that the... well, there's no country in the history of mankind, I don't believe, who have been more tightly sanctioned, theoretically, than North Korea. And what's not commonly known is that the Americans actually put the first sanctions on in 1950. And they've been tightening the screws ever since. And they're proposing to do it even more. But it's clearly not working because all the consumer goods are in the shops there, a lot of them made locally. And their military development has accelerated. So that this and the standards of living are rising and the economy is growing. So, I mean, the sanctions just don't work.
Well, it's really interesting because a lot of listeners don't realise that there was not a peace treaty signed between America and North Korea. There's an armistice. Can you explain?
Well, an armistice really is a sort of a... Oh, yes, there's no peace treaty. It was a ceasefire.
Yes.
Now, how that came about...
You'll have to do it in a very, very quick soundbite because it's led into...
It was very clear that neither side could prevail, and that still irks the American military.
Yes.
And a ceasefire was signed. And for the next 20 years, either side, if they could have had another go, they would have. But that all changed in 1971 because a certain gentleman by the name of Henry Kissinger went to China. Mm-hmm. And the following year, Nixon went to China. Suddenly, North Korea knew that if there was a showdown again, they could not necessarily rely on China. They thought about it a couple of months, and they made an overture to South Korea and said, this is silly, let's have a peace treaty. They did have talks, and there was a sort of loose joint agreement saying that it'd be a good idea to pursue, but nothing particularly happened. And every year since, in their New Year's speech, the successive Kims have asked for a peace treaty. In 73, it was clear that they weren't getting anywhere in South Korea. They wrote a letter to the House of Representatives and the Senate in the States asking for a peace treaty. They have never had a reply.
And so here we are today.
Yeah. Why have they never had a reply? Well, the answer is quite simple. It has nothing to do with North Korea. It has nothing to do with North Korea. I'll give you a documented quote from Condoleezza Rice.
Which is not necessarily the best person to be able to.
Well, it exposes the extreme cynicism of the situation and the complete lack of respect for other human life if you're not American. The quote is that North Koreans are like some sort of roadkill on the highway of history. Really, all of this that's going on is about America's, the United States, containment of China policy. They want to be able to maintain their bases in South Korea and Japan. They cannot say, we're keeping these bases here because we want them close to the throat of China. So they have fanned up this mirage of an aggressive, dangerous nation led by a madman, North Korea. And the South Korean public have bought it, and the Japanese public have bought it, and 99.5% of the whole world has bought this because the propaganda machine out of the United States is just so powerful. The truth of the matter is that the total GDP, the total economy of North Korea is around $40 billion per year. The total expenditure of South Korea military every year is $36.5 billion. So their military expenditure equates the total economy of North Korea. And of course, a lot of that is spent purchasing. I think South US. Korea is still the biggest buyer of arms in the world.
It'll be US arms too.
The Americans know that if there was peace on the Korean Peninsula, the people of Korea, South Korea, don't actually want the troops there. The people of Japan, Okinawa, they certainly don't want the troops there. They know that if there was peace, it would only be a matter of time that those troops would have to leave. They do not want this. The Pentagon. So there's a geopolitical thing. So that's the State Department. Now let's have a look at the Pentagon. The best assessments are that to the Pentagon, every year, the troops and bases in South Korea and Japan are worth $40 billion. The same as the total economy of North Korea. Now, no government department likes to lose $4 million, let alone $40 million, let alone $40 billion. So they certainly don't want it. So there's all sorts of pressures there in Washington to maintain that. In fact, it's outdated because in these days, with all their nuclear-powered submarines and their firepower and all their nuclear warships with their Trident missiles and so forth, they could, and they're circling the globe the whole time, and Reagan and Michigan, U.S. Michigan, they've been up and down the coast of Korea recently. Any one of those warships, they could simultaneously wipe out 19 cities the size of Auckland.
Yes, I hear you.
Now, they don't need those bases in Japan. They don't need those bases in South Korea because they could do anything they wanted against China or any other country in the world.
From sea.
From the sea or from anywhere. Yeah. So it's kind of outdated that they want to maintain their bases there, but there is that, you know, financial incentive to the Pentagon to keep it. Mm. So this puts you can start to understand the quote I gave you from Condoleezza Rice.
Yes, well, the military-industrial complex with all its other extensions is a train full steam and they're not wanting to pull it back. So one of the things is that North Korea also wants to defend itself, and in many ways it is said that it doesn't want to rely on any other country because the original Kims were really into having the country been self-sustaining and resilient in itself, but it has seen what has happened in Libya and also in Syria, and that is an extension of General Wesley Clark's communication on YouTube, where he said that Secretary Rumsfeld and the Pentagon was going to have America destabilize seven countries in the Eastern Mediterranean arc, including Syria as well, finishing with Iran. So, and General Wesley Clark talks about this. It's a very good interview by Democracy Now! And this is why refugees now are flooding Europe, solely because the US has destabilized that whole crescent in the Eastern Mediterranean. And so what I'm gathering is that Kim at the moment is wanting to make sure that he doesn't suffer from the same situation that particularly Libya and Syria has suffered from.
Well, there's an ex-CIA guy by the name of William Blum, B-L-U-M, and he's written a couple of books and published papers, and he's got a list of 57 countries since World War II where the American military has been involved in attempting and often successfully changing a regime. And if you bring the CIA into it and say places where the United States has tried to change regimes not using the military, the list would be much bigger. It is very significant that North Korea is not one of those countries. In fact, they are really the only country in the world who has really stood up to the United States, which makes them more hated too, of course.
Yes. Yes, well, they also belong to the non-allied movement.
That's kind of run out of steam, but they certainly do, yes.
Yes. And so we've got a situation where we have Donald Trump and we have Kim in power at the moment. And we have to find a way to address this. Now, Terence O'Brien, who used to be our ambassador to the United Nations, he's a very measured man.
Agreed.
And he is saying, look, we've got to sit at the table.
Agreed.
Mikhail Gorbachev, Ronald Reagan sat at the table. And they were able to work out the procedure that allowed Gorbachev to dismantle the Soviet Union. And he gave away a lot of the Soviet Union. And he wasn't wanting NATO to go up to the Russian borders either. That was a breach of the spirit.
Absolutely, it was.
A breach of the spirit of the agreement.
It's been disastrous.
But I maintain the imperative, Peter, is that when you sit down in negotiations like this, you end up bringing a grandchild in and sitting that grandchild on your knee and asking each other, what do you want for this child's future? I'm speaking with Peter Wilson. He is the secretary for the NZ-DPRK Society. You can find it on a Google search. I don't like using that name, Google. And it is the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the DPRK, often referred to as North Korea. Do a search for NZ-DPRK Society and check out their website. There's some interesting information that they wish to share.
Well, January last year, the North Koreans made a proposal. They said to the states, about the time Trump came in, they said, look, you freeze your war games
with South Korea.
With South Korea.
Yes.
And we will freeze our nuclear development program, and this will give us the space to talk. Washington said no. Now, things have got worse since that time. The tension is quite high. And one of the things that Trump has done, he has driven China and Russia together.
Even more.
Because just last week, Putin made a big speech saying that he agreed with China and a double freeze is necessary to defuse the situation. The double freeze, of course, is the freezing of the games and the freezing of the nuclear program and talking. So that's a lot of, it's a big part of the population of the world, really. And the academics in the States all around the world are all saying the same thing that Terence is saying. The only way out of this is to talk. We had good diplomatic relations, and our ambassadors were regularly visiting North Korea through the Helen Clark government years, and our Ministry of Foreign Affairs officials started to get some understanding of the plight of the North Koreans and the whole situation. But I'm sad to say that our current government has cut that, and we have had no diplomatic contact at all with the North Koreans now for 3 years. And it's Wellington's fault, not Pyongyang, because they want to talk, and they want to talk peace. I'd like to bring to your attention a letter that the North Koreans wrote to President Obama at the time of his second election. And this is what they said. We want a cessation of hostilities. We want a peace treaty. We want a recognition of our sovereignty. We want a lifting of sanctions. We want all foreign troops out of the Korean Peninsula. We want to talk about implemented an internationally agreed upon nuclear-free Korean Peninsula. The answer from Washington? Nothing.
Well, Obama would have been overridden instantly.
I am assured by the North Koreans that this is still their policy.
So it's on the table for Trump. Yes.
Mm.
Yes, well, the international community have got to come in and start pushing for, saying, let's get to this table, let's find a way, have it in a neutral country. I mean, Gorbachev and Reagan were in Malta. We can find this. And I think imperative that New Zealand, and particularly Norway, and maybe Austria, we can get some real good neutral peacemakers to come in and do it.
Well, I fully agree with you, but it's and I'm an optimist by nature, but it's hard to be optimistic on this. But it is very encouraging that this is exactly what Russia and China are saying. You mentioned the Norwegians. The Norwegians, you know, in our part of the world, tiny little country just like us, have had a huge impact in trouble areas, Aceh, Sri Lanka. They have been really active in there and working for peaceful solutions. And I talked to a Norwegian a couple of years ago in Pyongyang, and I brought this to his attention and said, but why aren't they doing anything about Korea? Because they've been so active working for peace in the Asia-Pacific region. He said, our government is too scared of
Uncle Sam.
Yes.
Well, this is where New Zealand can really stand up.
Yeah, well, there's no sign of it happening at the moment.
Not with the present administration in power at the moment, I agree. Mm. Peter, yes, there's lots that we want to talk about. Can I just jump back a bit?
Certainly.
We in New Zealand, we have MMP, Mixed Member Proportionate Representation. Mm. And it's got a few flaws, a bit of overhang in some places, and it can be manipulated by astute voting in groups and having certain groups pull back and not vote for their particular representative. What is the system in Korea? Because we have seen three successive family members gain power.
Right.
And we in New Zealand, I know all my listeners are going to jump on this one, so I can trust that you can allow us an understanding because, I mean, everything can change. Once we are stable, we have a stable country, then we can bring through more enlightened policies. But if we're in a war situation, we possibly want to keep things under control more.
Okay, well, first a little food for thought. President Moon Jae-in, I think, is the 19th leader of South Korea since the 50s. And they're currently working under their sixth different constitution.
Yeah.
So we talk about stability, and North Korea has had three leaders in that time. I look at the Kims, and I believe that they are very much in the Confucian mould. Kim is the father figure, and we're all part of a family.
Respect of elders.
That too, although, you know, we've got a young man there now. But the other thing is that by all this, and it is surreal, sort of adulation and focus on the Kims, but focus is the key word because it has allowed the North Korean population to really focus on their predicament of being not liked by the world's most powerful power.
Empire,
indeed. So they do fulfill a function in sort of pulling the resoluteness of the population. So far as free elections and all that sort of thing is concerned, well, it's no different from, really, from China, Laos, Vietnam. The party is in control. There are a few nominal little parties that are opposition. There are. But I mean, out of the, I'm not sure how many they have in their assembly, but there are half a dozen or maybe a dozen that are officially recognised opposition parties, but of course they don't wield any power.
Do they get into the so-called Politburo, for want of a better word? Do they, or is it essentially one particular party that's
overwhelming? No, the party is all powerful. And under Kim Jong-il, the military became more powerful. Under Kim Jong-un, with this Seventh Party Congress last year, he changed that, and instead of the sort of military-first policy that his father had, he's doing a dual thing of military and raising living standards and improving the economy, and it seems to be working very well. So if we look at China and Vietnam, which, of course, the North Koreans have very closely, they are working to go the same way. And they have changed the way that they are operating in country, preparatory for the day when they hope they can join the rest of the world and trade with the rest of the world. They're getting ready for it. When I first went there in 97, nobody spoke English. And English was really only taught in universities to train enough diplomats who could speak English. Today, the primary school, the secondary schools, and the universities all speak English. That's a sign. And that couldn't happen without the go-ahead from the top. They're getting ready to join the world.
Okay, yes. It's really interesting. I was in China 2003, and I was teaching up there. The school that I was at teaching, every classroom had a 42-inch TV set and hooked up to the web, and there's about 29 different stations or they could get onto, and every classroom had a solar hot water collector on the roof. Did you notice any of these things happening throughout Korea?
Oh, yes, they are. Their educational standards are very high. Everybody goes to school till 17, and then everybody, irrespective of what your field of life, a factory worker. Like, I went into a textile factory. There were 5,000 women and 5,000 men in that factory. Now, all of them had done 3 years of tertiary training, like correspondence, 1 month block course. All the workers on the farm cooperatives, after they leave school, they do 3 years tertiary training in agriculture. And if they aspire to become a manager or something like that, they do another 3 years. So everybody is highly educated, and I'm quite surprised, really, the number of computers that are in the schools these days.
Oh, that's interesting. I spent some time in the States recently with a scientist from SANDOS, which is a research laboratory for the United States government, in New Mexico. And also there's two research facilities. There's Los Alamos and there's SANDOS. And each one of them has close on 9,000 scientists all working together for the military industrial complex of America. So when we look at what's happening in Korea...
Yes. Interesting, yeah.
It is. It's profound.
But to go back to where we were on sort of democracy and yes, the control of the government and so forth, they are very conscious of what's happening in Vietnam and they are following and putting in the building blocks slowly up until 10, 15 years ago, 100% of all the food was distributed. Like, you got your family and therefore your eligible for X amount of food, and that was given to you by the state. Today, 30% of the food is traded in the markets. So that's a sort of indication of what's going on right through the economy. But they say we are not following exactly what the Chinese do, and we are not following exactly what the Vietnamese did with their doi moi, I think it's called, policy of marketisation. Why? Because it isn't working properly. The people in the cities in China are doing very well, but the people in the country are not. And they say that, they tell me that their study and evaluation of the Vietnamese system is that this inequality is worse than in China. And they say to me, looking me straight in the eye, and it's no better in the West, because the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. So they say, we have got no model, but we are committed to maintaining our socialist ideals, and we are looking for the way that we can modernise, that we can interact with the world global economy, but we can maintain egalitarian society, a fair society for our people. And I admire them for it.
Okay, now this brings through a whole thing on health. There'd be no junk food up there.
Not really, no.
No junk food, because what's happening, junk food in New Zealand is taking a whole lot of hospital beds. Mm-hmm. There are so many people now in their late 40s and their 50s with heart problems and diabetes, etc. Obesity taking up New Zealand hospital beds through junk food. You can check that one out. So they're on top of that. Their hospitals, did you manage to get into any of them or anything like
that? Yes. The top hospitals, of course, are incredible.
Who would go there? Ordinary people? Or is this for more of the higher echelons?
No, it is quite egalitarian. Their personnel are well trained. The budgets have improved a little bit over the last 3, 4, 5 years. Prior to that, really their problem was that they had the facilities, they've got the personnel, but they really didn't have the supplies and the drugs and so forth. That is getting better. I was in a children's hospital 2 years ago, and here was two nurses and a doctor with a great big TV screen, and on the screen was a medical worker somewhere out, I don't know, in the country, with a mother and a child, and I don't know what the issue was, but they were, these experts in Pyongyang, through this TV hookup, were interviewing and asking questions and providing advice. It was quite impressive. Medical services, and in fact all services in the country, there's not a lot of country towns, they're sort of regional centres, but everybody lives on the farm cooperatives, and those farm cooperatives all operate as an independent little business, and they're the shareholders.
Cooperatives.
So each cooperative has a medical centre. And so a typical medical centre there would see, you know, there's about 1,000 people live on a farm cooperative, and so their medical services and up to light surgery is right on the cooperative, and if it's more serious, they get sent into the town to the city hospital.
Interesting. I could talk to you for a long time.
I know.
because it's important for us to get a handle. Now, I've seen two YouTubes, and you can go up, and there's one on flying over Pyongyang as an aircraft, and I looked at that airport, and I saw the tarmac, and it was very good quality tarmac. IMEX Air New Zealand. So I look closely at things like this. But I could see the colours of the city too, which was interesting. It had a lot of blues, light blues on the roofs, and pinks on the roofs.
Yes.
And quite pleasant to look at.
Oh, yes, it's a beautiful city, and it has changed in the 20 years since I've been going there. The investment in housing in North Korea over the last 20 years is most remarkable. I would guess they have modernised or rebuilt 80% of the entire housing stock in the country in the 20 years that I've been going there. In 1997, it consisted of grey concrete apartment blocks, just square concrete blocks with square windows. Most of those have gone, and there are architecturally stunning apartment blocks. And they're building them so fast. We've got a housing issue here. It makes me feel like a third world country. In the 24 months since I was there last, they have built at least 15, 20, 30-storey brand-new apartment blocks. They were not there 2 years ago, but there they are today.
And lifts all the way up, because I know that when in China there was some, you had to walk certain floors up before you accessed a lift, but now it's coming to everybody. Mm-hmm. Yes. Now, can I ask one other question too? Because I've been in Russia a number of times, and I've been in China many times, and I managed to go up to Korea, and I have put one foot in North Korea. I went up there and put my foot over the demilitarized zone because I wanted to have one foot in North Korea and bring the two together. And I am an ecologist. What is the state of the ecology? Because I know that if I was living in China, even Russia and North Korea, I would become an activist very quickly.
Right. It's pretty good. It got a little bit out of control in the 90s because they authorised people in the rural towns and so forth to be able to go out and plant a veggie garden and so forth, and they did push up onto slopes that at that time that they should not have done. And I think there had also been a period a little bit earlier on when they had really harvested more forest than they should have done. Now, I haven't worked there since 2007, and I can't remember the numbers, but I remember being quite impressed with the numbers that I saw in 2007 of the statistics of the reforestation and the planting of trees that they had done in the previous 12 months. It's a fascinating landscape because of that not being able to grow quite enough. Every square metre of the country, even alongside the railway lines and everywhere, is
utilised.
There's nothing wasted. None of that arable land is not utilised.
Because what my concern is rivers. I've seen creeks in China that were as red as the Coca-Cola can. I've seen froth 200 metres wide, a metre high, going down rivers in China. Admittedly, that was in 1986. And I want to know, is Nick Smith, the environmental minister here in New Zealand, could swim and put his head underwater in a North Korean river?
I believe that he could, yes. They haven't. I mean, I saw Japan in 1969 and I was horrified at the pollution and the colour of all the rivers. They were black, you know, it was terrible. Yeah. They've since woken up and tidied things up. But they haven't got that. I wouldn't say there's no pollution, but they haven't got that so much industry. And all those mountains and everything, no, all the rivers that I've seen are running very clean, and I don't see the silt in them either.
Very good. Well, we got it now. We've only got 4 minutes. The people, Peter, I get on with most people. If you've got a smile, they'll reflect that smile, and away you go from there.
They're human beings just like you and me, and they're great people to interact with, and I've got some wonderful friends there, and I really enjoy the relationship with them. We are all human beings, and they're craving to be a part of the rest of the world.
I've seen videos of them dancing, and I've been into China. Chinese like dancing too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the Russians, there's this cultural thing of
They've kept alive their traditional culture and the music and the singing and the dancing. It's wonderful. And interestingly, you know, there were 3 million defectors out of East Germany and during the Cold War over there. In the whole history of North and South Korea, there's only been 30,000 defectors come out. And the numbers have dropped the last couple of years, which indicates this improvement of the economy. But some of those defectors in the South are making a very good living because they have retained all this old folk dances and music and everything, and they make quite a good living going round performing in South Korea.
Interesting. I was teaching here at Auckland Institute of Studies, and we had a Chinese guy who'd lived in Korea most of his life, and this is about 17 years ago, and he spoke to all the South Korean people in my classroom, and they looked at him and they couldn't believe it, because he had very, very, what you call a very conservative language base, and the South Koreans knew all these idioms and all slang, and they were totally up with the play from a global perspective. And yet this Chinese person who has been sort of living with North Koreans, he was just very polite, and the language was a great language gap.
Yes, well, that happens. I mean, you go to a country like the Philippines, and they are using words from the American time, and they're Victorian English. We don't use those words anymore. And the same thing, even just in the six decades that the two Koreas have been split, the languages have diverged, and, of course, there's all sorts of modern jargon and so forth in South Korea. It's still quite conservative and a bit old-fashioned in the North, yes.
Yes. Now, we want peace. We want peace on not only planet Earth, we need it on the Korean Peninsula. Peter, how can we pull this one together?
Well, the most important thing to me is that our next government, whatever it might be, immediately restore diplomatic relations with North Korea. That they agree that the ambassador to New Zealand from North Korea, who sits in Jakarta, and who asked 2 years ago for permission to come and present his credentials, he should immediately be sent. Come and present your credentials, and vice versa. And we should allow our diplomats to go to, our ambassador to go to North Korea, not dictate to them, as McCulley did, to preach to them about human rights and anti-nuclear. They are anti-nuclear. They're the only nuclear power who has signed that recent thing from the United Nations. None of the other nuclear powers.
Correct.
They want a nuclear-free Northeast Asia, and certainly not nuclear-free. So our diplomats should be allowed to go there and do what they're trained to do, to be diplomats, to understand their situation and talk with them and tell the rest of the world what the North Koreans are thinking and how they would be prepared to negotiate, because they do want peace. So I really hope our next government, whatever hue it is, has the wisdom to do that.
Wisdom is important. Could we not go to the United Nations and say we want this debated right here and now in the United Nations?
No.
And put our noise up? No?
It's a waste of time. The United Nations has unfortunately allowed itself to be used, and it has just become an instrument of American foreign policy.
I'm an optimist. I want this peace. You too.
Definitely.
Peter, thank you so much for coming. I think I've learned a lot, and I'm sure listeners will too.
My pleasure.
I have been speaking with Peter Wilson. He is the secretary for the NZ-DPRK Society. You can find it on a Google search. I don't like using that name, Google. And it is the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the DPRK, often referred to as North Korea. Do a search for NZ-DPRK Society. I invite you to be able to come to greenplanetfm.com, where we have over 400 interviews in our database, which you can readily download and listen to be able to inspire yourself to become the change you want to see in the world. And become involved in caring for your children and grandchildren's future. We are also on Facebook, on Green Planet FM and ourplanet.org. Please come and love us. This is Tim Lynch.
And or Lisa Eyre.
And Liz Gunn.
In the spirit of Aroha, wishing you a wonderful week. We look forward to being with you next week. I say kia kaha and haere ura.